Good evening. Welcome. Thank you for coming here this evening. My name is Lance Olson. I'm the executive director of the Spruce Peak Performing Arts Center, this beautiful room in which you are about to hear an amazing conversation. Isn't this a great place to have a conversation? Yeah. And this is Craig DeLuca. And Craig and I are together on the stage tonight because Craig represents Vermont Town Hall, a brand new organization that is all about conversations. And I represent the Spruce Peak Performing Arts Center, and together we were able to make this happen. We didn't actually make this happen. In your program book, there's a list of people on the back page who were absolutely essential to making the Spruce Peak Performing Arts Center the organization that it is today. These are members of our community. They're individuals, they're corporations, they're businesses, small businesses that are part and parcel of this community. Please take a look at this list. If you see someone in this audience, including you, who's here tonight and on the list, you're part of making this possible. Please thank them and thank yourselves for this conversation. Before we get started, please look to your left, look to your right. You'll see exits on both sides of the building. If an alarm were to go off, please stand up, put your coat over your arm, very gently and lovingly say to your neighbor, "Let's leave the building quietly," and just walk out the nearest exit. It won't happen, but if it does, you know what to do, and the fire marshal will be very happy with you. Now, Craig.
Thanks, Lance. Well, let me begin by introducing you to the rest of the Vermont Town Hall team, the lovely and talented Biddle Duke. Where's Biddle? The effervescent Katrina Vehrman. And the charming David Goodman, who will be coming out to moderate this evening. We conceived of this Vermont Hall Town series as a way to bring people together to discuss the important issues of the day in the Vermont tradition of open and respectful conversation. And our hope is that through this dialogue and future events, we'll all gain a deeper understanding of the world in which we live and create a pathway to deeper civic engagement. Now, tonight, you'll be part of a conversation with Bill McKibben, journalist, environmentalist, founder of 350.org, and the man that the Boston Globe dubbed the most important environmentalist of our times. We'll begin with 45 minutes of a conversation with David Goodman and Bill McKibben up here on stage, and then you'll join the conversation in one of two ways. You can either fill out the index cards that are in your program and hand them to one of the ushers who will come around with a basket, or you can use one of these two stationary mics to come up and ask your question. If you wouldn't mind waiting until the David Goodman asks you to do that. And I think, do we also have a handheld mic that we can bring around? You'll be able to ask your question. Let me apologize in advance. Already I can see there are way more questions than we have time for, but the goal is to get as many people's thoughts out so that we can keep the dialogue lively and, of course, civil. Any question is fair game as long as it's respectful, but please no speeches and rants, if you can help that. This is our first event. Guaranteed there are things about it that we can make better in the future. And to that end, you've been given some sticky notes in your program. If you wouldn't mind filling out any feedback that you have for us, and if there are specific speakers or topics that you want us to cover, write those down on separate stickies as well. And out in the hallway, we have two large whiteboards, one that says speakers and one that says general feedback. Yeah. And you can put the sticky notes up there and then look at what other people are putting to get sort of a sense of community going. Our hope is that you will eventually become active members of the Vermont Town Hall community. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. We have an email address. That's all in your program. And soon we'll have a website. Now, lastly, I'd like to thank Lance. When we brought this idea to Lance a couple of months ago, you embraced this enthusiastically and put the full weight of your office behind it to make it a reality. So thank you very much. I'd also like to thank our media sponsors and our advisory board who have given us tremendous guidance throughout this process, as well as financial support. And lastly, I'd like to thank you all for coming, for your open-mindedness, for your sense of civic engagement, and we hope this is just a tremendous experience for you. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you, David. Now, with no further ado.
Yes. And now, with no further ado, thank you, David Goodman and Bill McKibben will appear magically from behind the stage. Thank you very much.
These look so comfortable.
Wow.
Oh, disappear.
Well, thank you all for coming out. It's a month before town meeting, but we hope to invoke a little of that spirit of right here in Spruce Peak. So, Bill, you weren't supposed to save the world. You were supposed to write about other people saving the world. I think your story goes that in your senior year at Harvard, you received a call from the legendary editor of The New Yorker, William Shawn, and he was offering you a job before you even graduated, much to the envy of your fellow classmates like me, who were wondering what the heck we were going to do when we graduated. So naturally, you thought it was a joke and you hung up on him. And
I swore at him.
So I guess it took him a little time, 3 months to be exact, to get over that. And so tell me, how'd you spend your 20s? And what did you think you were going to do when you grew up?
Well, you know, it's funny. I assumed that I'd be a newspaper man, and I'd never really read The New Yorker, except to look at the cartoons and things. But I went off to, I went off to New York. And this was at the very end of Sean's, you know, long, wonderful reign at The New Yorker, the greatest editor of the 20th century. And it was the measure of the man that we were very close, and we spent 5 years working very closely together. And never once did either of us feel it necessary to comment on the fact that how our relationship had begun with me swearing at him on the phone. Pretending, assuming it was a prank call. And I wrote Talk of the Town stories, which in those days were anonymous, which was a wonderful way to write, and it spent 5 years just learning New York City. And my boast was at one time that I'd gotten out at every subway stop in New York City at one time or another. And then the forces of commerce did their thing, and Cy Newhouse bought The New Yorker, and he fired Mr. Shawn. And the day he fired Mr. Shawn, I quit and moved up to the Adirondacks, out into the woods, and started writing books.
And the first book that you wrote at age 27 was The End of Nature, which became an international bestseller. And taking a page out of This Is Your Life, I happen to have a page. So I'd like you to read a paragraph of the 27-year-old Bill McKibben's thoughts on the world.
It's sort of regarded, I guess, as the first book about climate change for a sort of non-scientific audience. And I don't really quite even remember this passage. It's about... at this writing, the greenhouse effect shows every sign of emerging as an important political issue, perhaps the important political issue. President Bush has scheduled a global scientific workshop on the topic for the fall of 1989. There's much talk of an international convention to draw up a treaty on climate change modeled on the accords to phase out chlorofluorocarbons. It all sounds promising, rational. There should be a solution, and we should write our congressmen about it, and they should enact it, and then we should all get on with our lives. We should come up with a good practical response, a plan, a series of steps, a 7-point proposal to solve the greenhouse effect. That is the modern way. That is our reflex. But there are reasons, economic and demographic reasons, but also reasons of chemistry and physics, to think such an approach won't work so easily in this case, that a solution may be difficult, verging on impossible. And I wish that I had been incorrect about that, but probably that last sentence, which I haven't read in 25 years, is as good a prediction as any about what was going to happen in the intervening quarter century.
So what would the 50-something Bill McKibben, with the wisdom you have now, what would your words of advice be to the 20-something Bill McKibben who wrote that book?
Well, I mean, in a way, that I think the thing I kick myself for is not fully appreciating what I wrote there, understanding how hard it was going to be. You know, like everybody else, the assumption is that when we come up against a really difficult problem, this society we've built, this society based on reason with institutions that more or less have carried us through a lot of things, will kind of rise to the occasion and you know, in a messy but some kind of way, deal with the problem. And they just haven't with climate change. There's been, and it was only 5 or 6 years ago that it really became sort of deeply clear to me that reason was not going to prevail in this case, that power was going to prevail, that there was so much money in the fossil fuel industry that they were going to keep doing what they were doing until the planet was broken, and that we'd need to find some other way. We need to find some other source of power. It wasn't going to be money. They have all the money. I mean, literally, they've got more money than God. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay, so we'd have to find other currencies to work in, the currencies of movements, you know, power, you know, passion, spirit, creativity, numbers. And that's when we started doing things that are completely, really foreign to my character and experience, like organizing 350.org or things. But those, you know, movements we probably should have built a quarter century ago, instead of waiting around, you know, watching, working year after year as, you know, our best scientists went up to Capitol Hill and said what was the worst thing in the world was happening, and then no response, nothing. I mean, we've had a 25-year bipartisan effort in this country to do nothing about climate change, and it's been quite successful.
What was the moment when you went from writer, from outsider looking in, to activist, to deciding to do this
yourself?
Well,
there was no, you know, bright line. But there were moments when it just became clearer to me, you know, this isn't working. And I remember going to Bangladesh probably 7 or 8 years ago, doing some reporting because Bangladesh is the perfect example of a country that's taking it in the neck from climate change already. I mean, the Bay of Bengal is, you know, the whole country is only 6 or 7 feet above sea level, and already the Bay of Bengal eats away at, and the Brahmaputra, you know, has its origins up in the glaciers of the Himalayas, and they're disappearing. But when I was there, they're having their first big outbreak of dengue fever, which is this mosquito-borne disease spreading very rapidly, fast as the WHO said will be the endemic disease of the 21st century, because the mosquito that spreads it, Aedes aegypti, really likes the warm, wet world that we're building on its behalf. And it's in some ways worse than the malaria mosquito because it's not nocturnal, it's diurnal. I mean, you have to stay in your bed net all day to avoid it, you know. So they were having their first big outbreak of dengue there, and there are a lot of people dying. And I was spending a lot of time in the slums, so eventually I got bit by the wrong mosquito and got dengue, and I was as sick as I'd ever been. But, you know, I was strong and healthy and well-fed going in, so I didn't die. Now, lots of people dying, and I remember going to the, you know, clinic, room bigger than this, is, you know, just people on cots spreading, you know, shivering. Not much. There's no treatment for it because only poor people get it. So why would you bother to figure one out? But I remember thinking, this is like the absolute summit of unfairness, you know. When the UN tries to measure how much carbon each country in the world emits, there's 180 million people or something in Bangladesh, so almost two-thirds of our population, but you can't even get a number for how much carbon they emit. They're a rounding error. You know, most of them don't have electricity. Still in Dhaka, the bicycle rickshaw is an important, you know, means of transit. They're not causing the problem, they're just dying. And so, I remember just coming back here and thinking, one of the first thing we did, and I had no idea what I was doing, but I'm sure there are people in this room who helped. We just, we organized this march up the western side of Vermont from Robert Frost's old riding cabin up in the Green Mountains up to Burlington. We walked for 5 days. We slept in farm fields along the way. Since I was Methodist Sunday school teacher at one point, I called up all the Methodist mafia en route, and there were potluck suppers, you know, and things. And we got to Burlington, and there were 1,000 people marching. I mean, it was great. I remember we got to the outskirts of Burlington, and Bernie comes out to greet us, and he's incredibly happy. He's like, I haven't seen a crowd like this since Vietnam days. This is great. This is so fantastic. What's this about again? He's become the greatest champion of climate stuff in the whole U.S. Senate. But we got to Burlington. We did this great rally. And then there's this story in the Free Press the next morning. The story says those 1,000 people, and this was 2006, that 1,000 people may have been the largest rally that's yet taken place in the U.S. about climate change. It's like, no wonder we get nowhere. You know, you have everything you would need for a movement. You have Al Gore, you have scientists, you have policy people, you have all the superstructure of a movement. The only part we forgot was the movement part, you know. There's nothing there to give it any heft to worry people at all. And so that's the part that we've been trying to fill in these last years with, you know, a certain amount of beginner's luck, you know, some of the time. But we should have done it long ago. I should have done it long ago.
Well, you wrote an article for Rolling Stone, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, 3 simple numbers that add up to global catastrophe and that make clear who the real enemy is. So can you just explain what those 3 numbers
sure.
are?
So this was going on 2 years ago, I guess, now, and it was, oddly enough, it turned into one. It was... Keep your back issues. It was one with Justin Bieber on the cover, but it turned into the most widely shared article in the magazine's history online, anyway, and it laid out this sort of math, which even though I'd written the first book about all this, was still kind of new to me. I mean, there were 3 numbers. The first number is 2 degrees Celsius, so 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. That's what the world has said, the world's governments, all governments, including ours, have signed on. The only things they've signed on to internationally are these pledges to try and hold temperature increase below 2 degrees Celsius, because everything we know indicates that beyond there lies complete chaos. In fact, we now think that number is too high. Jim Hansen and a bunch of other scientists published a paper 6 months ago saying the 1 degree that we've already raised temperature is clearly way too high, and the Arctic is melting. And is, but the only things the world's agreed to is this 2 degrees. So, you know, that's what we have as a kind of leverage. That's first number. Second number, scientists, you know, computer models give us a pretty good, pretty close indication of how much more carbon we can burn and have reasonable hope of staying below 2 degrees. And it's maybe 500 gigatons more carbon, okay? 500 billion tons, which sounds like a lot, but we're burning through 34, 35 billion tons a year now, and it's going up 3% a year, so that gives us like 13 years or something before we, which is a scary enough number, okay? But we kind of knew all that. The third number, the really scary one, came from his team of financial analysts in the UK, who for their own purposes did the work of adding up how much carbon was in the reserves of the fossil fuel industry, the fossil fuel companies and the kind of countries that operate as fossil fuel companies, so Venezuela. And when you add up all their proved reserves, the stuff they've already identified, located, and told their regulators and shareholders and banks that they're going to dig up and burn, it adds up to about 2,800 gigatons of carbon, or 5.5 times past what any scientist thinks we could safely burn. And once you know that, then there's no longer, it's not like there's any doubt about the end of this story. There's no speculation or, you know, wishful thinking to be done or anything else. If these guys carry out their business plan, then the planet tanks, end of story. They've announced they're going to do it. It's down in black and white. And once I saw that, actually, sat down one night and talked about it with my old friend Naomi Klein, who you know, a Canadian economist and writer. And we both sort of reached the same conclusion. Once you know this fact, then you understand that the fossil fuel industry isn't a normal industry. It's a rogue industry, in a sense. Not only are they have these reserves that are far, but even in the face of knowing about climate change, they continue to constantly look for more. I mean, Exxon proudly boasts that they spend $100 million a day looking for more hydrocarbons. That's their exploration budget. There's a kind of madness there. And it led us both in the same direction. This is a place where, one of the kind of rare places where we really need a kind of divestment movement of the kind that you helped run a quarter century ago about apartheid in South Africa, the last big sort of expression of this. And that's, we've sort of tried to foment that in the time since.
So, and I'm curious about how you arrived on tactics. So why divestment? What gave you the idea? You also knew, looking back, the South Africa movement, it took a long time.
It took a long time. But usually when you're faced with sort of corporations doing bad things, I mean, you know, people have done a lot of good work over the years on shareholder activism and bringing pressure to bear, and, you know, I mean, usually that's enough. If Apple is paying its Chinese workforce slave wages, you know, then you bring, you know, the response is not to say we're now never have an iPhone again or something. The response is to bring all the tools, the sort of obvious tools, shareholder pressure and publicity and threats of, and so then Apple says, okay, we'll pay them, you know, we'll double their pay, and then the price of an iPhone goes up $2.50, and everybody's happy, you know. That's the normal. In this case, the problem was not that there was a flaw in the business plan of Exxon. The flaw is the business plan, okay? That's their whole business plan. We dig up carbon and make sure it gets burned. And not only is that what we do as a business, we spend our massive lobbying budget making sure that nobody ever changes the ground rules. Nobody ever puts a serious price on carbon to reflect the damage it does in the atmosphere, so on and so forth. So it seemed to us that it was one of these rare cases where people needed to break those ties. Not on the theory that we can bankrupt Exxon. We can't, even any more than you managed to bankrupt GE, you know, when they were doing business in South Africa. But you did manage to politically bankrupt them at some level. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, one of the first trips he took was to the U.S., and he didn't go first to the White House. He went first to California to thank students in the UC system who had forced the sale of $3 billion worth of stock. There are 155 college campuses that sold their stock. And he said, you know, we worked pretty hard to free ourselves, you know, in South Africa, but we actually couldn't have done it without your help, too. It was Mandela's great accomplice, one of my great heroes, Desmond Tutu, who made the video that we used to launch this divestment campaign. He said, if you could see what's happening in Africa as a result of climate change, the drought and the famine, then you'd understand why I'm asking you to take up this same tool again a quarter century later. And he said, as he pointed out, it's not like we have some other means of doing this. We use less than 1% of the world's fossil fuel. It's not like we're going to, you know, we need your help putting pressure on the where this comes from. So it's So we've tried, and it's about a little more than a year old, this campaign. And Oxford put out a study, Oxford University, of 2 months ago, saying this was the fastest growing corporate campaign of its kind in history. There are 300 and some college campuses on this country where there's active fights underway. 10 have already divested, 10 or 12. A number of cities, Seattle, San Francisco, the United Church of Christ. I've been much of last year in Australia and New Zealand and across Europe launching it in those places with similar kind of results. It's hard, and it's only one front in this fight, and we spend an all, but it's, I got to say, it feels good. Most of the time, we seem to be playing defense, fighting the Keystone Pipeline, fighting, you know, coal ports in the Northwest, fighting coal mines in Australia, on and on and on. Just sort of endless Dutch boy sticking his, you know, we're just running out of fingers, you know, and there's so many holes. But it's kind of good to feel like you're on offense against these guys. And the most useful part of it has been that analysis, which was, you know, 2 years ago, sort of me and Rolling Stone next to Justin Bieber, is now, you know, basically everybody's adopted. The World Bank, the International Energy Agency, the IMF, they've all put out big papers with exactly this same kind of math. Look, there's a carbon bubble. They're going to have to be stranded assets. You know, it's using that same math. So that part's been very useful.
And just this week, we read that a number, 17 big global foundations are divesting $2 billion out of their fossil fuel holdings. So,
and they were like, you know, one of them said, one of these guys running one of these foundations said, look, we give all these grants to people to try to work on these problems around the environment and climate change. Why would we be investing in companies that are causing the problem in the first place?
But one notable holdout, your own college, Middlebury College.
Several, I mean, our alma mater, Harvard.
They'll always be the last.
There's a great piece in The Nation today. And the president of, a guy who was president of Oberlin and Franklin and Marshall and Reed, president of three colleges, writing a just pretty withering attack on these letters that Harvard and Brown issued. The holdout that bothers me more is state of Vermont. There is no reason. I mean, this state should not be divesting its holdings in these companies. And I've tried to interest Peter Shumlin and Treasurer Pierce and things, but gotten no reaction so far. Oh, you know, we should. I was saying at dinner to Ken Squire, our great source of all sort of history in Vermont, the man who has seen it all. I said, I wasn't here when the Progressive Party got formed, and I never kind of quite understood, you know, like where it came from. And now I sort of understand more, you know. It's infuriating to watch a state where we have a Democratic governor, Democratic supermajorities in both the House and the Senate, but we get almost nothing done. You know, our image of Vermont as an environmental powerhouse dates back to the Kunin administration. We're not doing anything at the moment to deserve this accolade. You know, the state Senate spends more of its time, you know, trying to prevent people from doing wind turbines than it does anything else, as far as I can tell. And so I think there might be people here tonight from 350 Vermont, maybe. If there are, I think they might even have postcards or things to pass out. I hope people will send a note to Governor Shumlin saying, you know, this would be an easy, obvious gesture. It's not going to win the fight against global warming, but it will put pressure on these guys. It would be appropriate for Vermont to join Seattle and San Francisco and Providence, Rhode Island, and, you know, jurisdictions around the country in divesting from fossil fuel, selling off those holdings, especially since, as study after study shows, there's no financial penalty attached to doing so. If you had, someone just did a study a little while ago, the AP commissioned a study. They said if you 10 years ago had $1 billion endowment or $1 billion pension fund and you'd invested it in a fossil-free portfolio, you would have made an extra $119 million over the last decade. Okay, which would have paid for a lot of things around the state of Vermont, you know. So it's good business and good sense. I guess one way to look at it is, last year, HSBC, the second biggest bank in the world, published a study saying, if we took this 2-degree target seriously, if the world put in place the policies that would actually hold us below 2 degrees, it would cut the value of fossil fuel shares 60% around the world, that on average. Okay? So if you own them, if you own Exxon or Chevron or something, in essence, you are making a bet that the world will never take action on climate change. Okay? That's the bet that Treasurer Pierce or Governor Shumlin, whatever, is making, that we'll never act on this. And that's, I don't know whether it's a wise bet or not, but it's not a moral bet to be making at this point.
The other big focus of your energies has been the Keystone XL pipeline. Why Keystone as a tactic for attacking climate change?
I wish it had been the only, it's one of many, because there are fights that, 350.org works in 181 countries around the world, every country except North Korea. And so there are fights like this going on many places, okay? But in this country, yes, Keystone became a big fight. In 2011, in the spring of 2011, I'd never really paid much attention to this thing. To the tar sands in Canada. I knew that it was kind of a bad scene up there and whatever, but there's like 100 bad scenes around the world. And, you know, so that spring, Jim Hansen, our greatest climatologist, published this paper saying, people might want to pay attention to these tar sands. There's a lot of carbon up there. It's one of the 6 or 7 biggest deposits of carbon on Earth. If you dug up all the economically recoverable oil up there and burned it, as he said, it would be game over for the climate. You would take the atmospheric concentration of CO2 from its current roughly 400 parts per million, already way too high, already past the 350 parts per million mark that represents some kind of safety. You'd take that 400 parts per million and just from Alberta run it up to about 540 parts per million. Okay? Well, the reason that we took it on was partly because of that and partly because, for once, President Obama had an easy way to put the kibosh on this without having to ask John Boehner and, you know, anybody else. He has president has to sign off on infrastructure crossing the national border. So before they can put this pipeline in, they need a presidential permit. So we were like, okay, this is the guy who said in his campaign in 2008, in my administration, the rise of the oceans will begin to slow, you know. We will end the tyranny of oil. Okay, good. Here's an easy one for you to do. Do it. Not so easy. I mean, so far it's taken the largest civil disobedience action about anything in this country in 30 years, 1,200 people going to jail. It's taken the biggest outpouring of public comments about any environmental issue ever, like we think about 2 million public comments into the State Department. Taken the largest day of phone calls and emails to the Senate in its history, 800,000 in a day, and it's still a completely toss-up question whether or not President Obama will block this thing or not. The State Department came out with a report today that just continues to kind of muddy the water, and so I think we'll find out sometime in the next 6 months, you know, what's going to happen. And we'll continue to fight as hard as we can. Monday night, there'll be vigils around the country. I assume there'll be one in Burlington, although I don't know, but you can easily find out by going to 350.org or wherever and looking. The only reason that it's a fight is because we've had people out in the streets in massive numbers, and that's what it'll take to win this, and I'm afraid that's what it'll take to win a lot of other things. As I said at the beginning, it shouldn't have to be that way. Reason should dictate that we, you know, just get to work doing the things we know how to do. Put a price on carbon. Put huge effort behind building renewables, things like that. But we're not going to do it without a fight because the richest industry in the history of the world is on the other side of this fight.
Your wife wrote to you a little over a year ago that you had spent more nights in jail than you had spent at home. What's up with that? Why are you going to jail?
I've been trying to be home a good deal more and want to be home. As I say, this is not my what I'm cut out for, and I don't. You can tell I'm ill at ease standing up speaking, and
you're doing all right.
You and Jasper are the pros at this kind of work, and Ken, I do what I can, but it's not what I mean, I'm a writer. Left to my druthers, I'd, like to be alone in my room typing, That's sort of what turns me on. We'll keep doing this as best we can, and the pleasure is in watching this movement build and seeing it build all over the world. And to me, we've organized about 20,000 demonstrations now around the world. CNN called it the most widespread political activity in the planet's history. And it all began in Vermont. We started 350.org with myself and 7 undergraduates at Middlebury, and then 5 years ago, and we've built out from there. And mostly it's been just by deploying endless amounts of volunteers. I mean, I'm a volunteer, and almost everybody who's associated with this thing is it's not even really an organization in the way that we think of, like, the Sierra Club or something. It's basically just a kind of endless series of campaigns designed to let everybody take part. But that means that everybody has to take part, right? It doesn't happen unless people are willing to get involved. You don't have to go to jail, though we'll give you opportunity if you want to, But we do badly need you doing things, because otherwise, this is the worst thing that ever happened to the world, at least in human time. And it's happening with extraordinary speed. And the consequences are almost unfathomable. But basically, they boil down to the fact that we're not going to have civilizations like the ones we're used to having by the end of this century, unless we're able to bring the rapid rise in temperature of the planet under control. Already, even with a 1 degree increase in temperature, we're seeing incredibly erratic and difficult weather that's causing agriculture to become. We were talking about this with Elizabeth earlier today. You can't. 2012 was the warmest year in American history by a lot, by a full degree, which is statistically improbable.
And your Twitter feed is a daily accounting of record-breaking around the world, depressing.
But what happened in 2012 here was that you couldn't grow food in the richest, most fertile farmland on the face of the earth. There's 100 feet of topsoil in Iowa, but it doesn't help you any if the temperature's above 95 degrees day after day and the corn won't fertilize. Probably a quadrillion kernels of corn failed to fertilize in the summer of 2012 across the Midwest. The price of corn on global markets went way, way up. Lots of poor people didn't get near enough to eat as a result. Right now, California is in the grips of a just epic drought. There was a paper yesterday saying it's almost certainly the deepest drought since at least 1580. In California, okay? So it's a good thing that we don't depend on California for food or anything like that,
So all of which leads you to write about honeybees.
Mm.
Your latest book, Oil and Honey, which is really a wonderful read, and I've been enjoying it over the last few weeks, you profile a man who is essentially your alter ego. Kirk Webster is a beekeeper in Ripton.
No, in New Haven.
In New Haven. He doesn't have internet. He lives a monastic life in a one-room home with 200 books. What drew you to him?
Kirk is great and an old friend and the best apiarist I know. He really was one of two or three first apiarists in the country to manage to do chemical-free beekeeping on a big scale that really worked and worked really well. His hives have avoided the colony collapse and things that have just, we think we may have lost half the beehives in the U.S. last year. So he's, and he's an incredibly beautiful guy. And for me, it was the book's half about this sort of endless, stupid, constant travel and work and whatever of trying to build movement, and half about when I was home, the sane productive, useful life that Kirk lives, but that we can't have unless we're able to bring the climate under some kind of control. Look, Vermont's done more about food, local food, than just about any place in the country, you know? We really have been. But when Irene came through, an awful lot of the casualties, besides people who had the misfortune of living in trailer parks, and the other big casualties were one of them anyway, were river bottom farms. An endless number of great, beautiful organic farms and CSAs and things that people had built for years. I mean, you know, goodness knows your wife's done an enormous amount to help us recover from Irene, but there's a certain kind of recovery that's just impossible. If these become, as the scientists tell us they will, sort of rainstorms and things on this scale, a kind of regular occurrence, I mean, it doesn't matter how beautiful your organic, if it doesn't rain for a month, or if it rains, you know, 13 inches in a day, you're not growing anything, you know. And that's the world that we're building.
You write very poetically about honeybees themselves and how they're organized. Tell us what we can learn from honeybees.
Well, I'm trying to think what I, there was a, I really do like honeybees, and I didn't before. I was sort of always scared of bees. I once was hiking in the woods in the Adirondacks and stepped on a yellow jacket nest and got like 75 or 80 stings. And ever since then, I'd been, I have to carry around one of those
pens
to jab in your thigh and things. And but I really did get to like honeybees. And there was a section in this book where I was kind of thinking about I was thinking about their kind of, how they were different and like human beings, you know, and what, and it was the same week I was thinking, I was out in the road and we were, for some reason, it must have been right when Citizens United was being decided, you know, this court case that said that corporations were people, you know, which seemed a dumb idea to me, but I couldn't quite put my finger on exactly why, you know, but it occurred to me that there was a way in which we were out one day with Kirk. I was out in the bee yards with Kirk working with him, and he said, "Watch this, it's kind of funny." And he turned the beehive 90 degrees. So the entrance, the little entrance where the bees come in and out, was like 8 inches away from where it had been before. And instantly, it's like airplanes over O'Hare on a thunderstorm day. Suddenly, they're just, the bees can't find the new entrance. They're just they're bees which can travel miles and get their way back to the right beehive, you know, astonishing. But the minute you move the door, they couldn't find it. And then finally, after like 30 seconds, it was too much for both of us to watch, and we just turned it back around so they could get, you know, and remember thinking, bees and corporations in this sense at least are alike, okay? That they're both very productive and very simple. Like if you want to go collect honey from, you know, collect nectar and turn it into honey from a vast field, you need a hive of bees, and it works really well. If what you want to do is go get oil from the tar sands of Canada or whatever, you need a corporation. That's the sort of organization that's capable of bringing together the huge variety of resources necessary to make this happen, and capital, and, you know, so on and so forth. But if you wanted to figure out whether or not making honey was a good idea, the last people you'd want to ask would be bees, okay? You already know what their answer is going to be. And if you want to know whether or not it's a good idea to go take the tar sands and pump them into the atmosphere, it's incredibly stupid to let corporations act, you know, to let them act as people and spend money on political campaigns and things, because they're simple. The virtue of human beings is that we're complex. Yes, we have instincts and drives like bees or corporations, okay? But we also have all these complicating factors, art or religion or whatever else it is, that sometimes cause us to act counter our instincts, you know, make us more complicated and interesting. in those ways. And that's why it's such folly to treat corporations as to give them that kind of voice, because it's not as if they're going to use that voice to do something interesting. They're just going to use it to further their incredibly simple aims, aims that are useful when they're controlled, you know, but that are dangerous when they're not.
So a funny thing happened between when you finished writing your book and when it came out. You wrote an essay essentially disagreeing with the book that was about to come out. And it was a quote from an essay you wrote that came out last August called Movement Without Leaders. You write, "In recent months, and it's the curse of an author, that sometimes you change your mind after your book is in type. I've come to like the idea of capital L leaders less and less. Mm. It seems to me to miss the particular promise of this moment that we could conceive of and pursue movements in new ways." So is this the end of Bill McKibben, the environmental leader?
In some sense, I hope. I think that one of the things that, and I think maybe writing about bees helped me realize it in a sense, one of the things that's interesting about the moment in which we live is that the one thing that's really changed in my lifetime, technologically, that's changed the way the day works and things, was the advent of the internet, okay? And it's not just that it changed the way, it's the way it changed our sense of the possible kind of architectures of the world. So we're very used to this idea that there will be, if you grew up when we did, say, that information would come from three TV networks and, you know, we would absorb it and, you know. Now, people who grow up now are very used to the idea that they're going to be, in essence, broadcasting themselves all day, putting things on Facebook or whatever it is. Information system works in reverse. There are a million nodes all pushing out, you know, and that the network effect of those is what's interesting and powerful. That's exactly the kind of model we need for, say, food, a very networked, smaller, local food network where, you know, the farmer's market is a kind of internet in calories, you know, in a way. It's exactly the model that we need for energy instead of a few huge power plants, you know, Vermont Yankee doing it. We need windmills in tons of places and solar panels on tons of roofs and them all, you know. I like the idea that the, you know, sunlight that falls on my shingles in Ripton like cools my neighbor's beer before the Red Sox game, you know, that appeals to me. And probably in our political life too. I mean, I think, you know, growing up when we did, we have this notion that movements have like leaders, like, you know, Martin Luther King, and that's, you know, whatever. I mean, in fact, if you look at the history carefully, even Martin Luther King wasn't Martin Luther King. You know, there were hundreds of other people doing incredibly important personal lives. But now we have this possibility, and that's what I was writing about in this piece, sort of describing as a kind of fossil fuel resistance almost. The adversary that we have in this greatest of all fights that there's ever been is sprawling and protean. It's everywhere. Okay, so the resistance to it needs to be sprawling and protean and coming at them from every angle. And that's increasingly what we have. Hundreds. So just to give the, you know, one example, like 350 Vermont, okay? It shares a name with 350.org, which I helped found. But basically, it sprung up on its own. I don't have, I mean, except for supporting it and applauding it and things, I mean, it's not like they ask me what to do, you know? And there's 1,000, we have there's probably 10,000 environmental groups around the world that we work with when we do these big global days of action and things like that, and we all just able to network together. So I think that's a far better analogy, you know? I like that kind of world.
So how do we win this fight and save ourselves and the world?
Well, I mean, you know.
Small question.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, first thing I should say is I'm not certain we're going to. I mean, the name of the book I wrote about all this 25 years ago this year was The End of Nature, okay? So I'm no Pollyanna.
You're known for your upbeat titles.
Yes, I know. But I think the only way to do it is to fight as hard as we can on every front. And it's why, I gotta say, it's why it pisses me off when we see so little action in, like, Montpelier, okay? Because I get it that I have to, you know, we have to work, like, incredibly hard when we're in Kazakhstan or, you know, Nigeria or whatever. I mean, some places are really poor, they're completely dependent on the energy industry, or people just don't know about things or whatever. Vermont, we should be actually leading the fight. It's shameful that everybody's going to have to fill out a postcard tonight to get the governor of Vermont to do the right thing about fossil fuel investments, okay? That should be a no-brainer. We shouldn't have to call him. He should have, you know, seen it on, he should have been watching Democracy Now and seen the first mention of it and gotten on it himself right away, you know? But, so we need you tonight to do that, and we'll need you next week to follow up, and, you know, so on and so forth. The only way to do it, the only way that you counter as much power as there is in the fossil fuel industry is to try and build power on the other side. It's the only way that I can think of. I wish there was some shortcut. We've got most of the technology that we need. That's the good thing that wasn't true 25 years ago. We really do. I mean, there were days this summer when the Germans generated more than half the power they used from solar panels within their borders. There are days this winter when the Germans will generate half the power they use from wind turbines within their borders. They're the one country that's done it sort of seriously, you know? And trust me, I mean, Germany, some of you have been to Germany. It's definitely no more sunny than Vermont, you know? It's sort of Wagnerian and foggy and, you know, whatever. But there are more solar panels right now in Bavaria than there are in the United States, okay? That's political will. That's not anything else.
What gives you hope?
Well, the sheer number of people who are willing to get involved in this work and do it all over the world. So one of the things we like doing at 350.org when we do these days of action, some of these huge things we've done around the globe. We did one day where there were 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries, I guess. And there were pictures of almost all of them in these gatherings in every corner of the world, you know, and the most far out, you know, Maasai tribal areas of Kenya, or, you know, on top of the highest peak in the Antarctic, whatever, and just... Sometimes if I get discouraged, I'll just sit there. We have about 40,000 pictures in the Flickr account, you know, and I can sit and look through a few of them and just, you know, look, if some guy in Bangladesh willing to gather 500 of his neighbors and have a demonstration and be engaged, you know, I mean, if I was in Bangladesh, I'd be so angry at the rest of the world and at the West and things for wrecking my country. I don't think some American said, let's do that. I forget it. Go away. That people are willing to be engaged in that way. Seems to me to make it incumbent on the rest of us to do something likewise.
Well, just before turning it over to the audience, I have one last question about something that I know I think you're equally passionate about as you are about climate change. What has being a lifelong Red Sox fan taught you about how to save the world?
Well, there really was, you know, in 2004, some one had completely given up that this would ever, you know. I mean, there was this sort of nice sense that once in a while, grace, unearned grace, just smiles on you, and suddenly, you know, Big Poppy is poking home runs over the, you know. So that was good. But I, you know, Jasper just told me at dinner that the Red Sox are coming in second in the AL East this year. So, you know, back to the real world.
All right. Well, on that note, what we're going to do now is turn it over to you all, and we're going to alternate questions from the floor with any written questions. So I think somebody will
Do you want some water
collect
here?
Sure.